I'd like to start by just giving a brief perspective on what I'll be discussing. So, starting with some generalities on warped compactification. So, of course, we're all familiar with the standard compactification scenario in string theory, where you have four-dimensional flat or nearly flat space, and then compactification on some manifold, which might, for example, be a Calabi-Yau manifold. And so warped compactification involves modifying this just slightly. One still retains a set of symmetries that is includes the Poincaré symmetry in four dimensions, but one imagines that there can be a scale factor that enters in front of the four-dimensional metric, and that that scale factor depends on where you are on the internal manifold. Also, perhaps the dilaton could vary over the internal manifold as well. And a simple sort of paradigm for this, an example where we've seen this kind of behavior, is in the context of anti-de Sitter space, where we have in the Poincaré slicing, a four-dimensional set of four-dimensional slices whose scale factor depends on the coordinate in the fifth direction. So this is actually an important feature because it leads to the possibility of large redshifts between different four-dimensional slices, and we'll actually be using that some in this talk. For example, you might imagine as a picture of such a compactification, some kind of six-manifold, maybe somewhat akin to a Calabi-Yau six-manifold, that has some region that is approximately anti-de Sitter space, say times a compact manifold like a five-sphere, and you might imagine that you could develop a large redshift in traveling sort of down that throat. And of course, each point in this picture corresponds to a four-plane, to R4, and so this is, I'll denote the warped product by that. Okay, so that's what warped compactifications are. They're just a slight generalization of ordinary compactifications. Why should we study them? Well, they do present a new set of tools for low-energy phenomenology. And in particular, they're, basically generalizations of these brain world or brainification scenarios, which are somewhat different from ordinary compactification, as we know. So these are more generic than standard compactifications, obviously, and it's interesting to try to figure out what other kinds of phenomena one might find in these things. Interesting point is that in these warped compactifications, if you develop large regions that look like anti-de Sitter space, you've got the question of how to extend the ADS-CFT correspondence to a compact setting where the anti-de Sitter space doesn't have an infinity in the usual sense, but instead is terminated in this compact region on the six-manifold. But I think the most interesting reason, at least for the purposes of this talk, to discuss these things, is that they potentially yield new ways to generate hierarchies. And in particular, and this comes from these large possible relative redshifts between different points on the six-manifold. And in particular, they suggest ways that one might lower the Planck scale and perhaps even find scenarios where you have observable physics at scales that are much lower than the apparent four-dimensional Planck scale. It's also been suggested that they address the biggest hierarchy problem of them all, but since I don't believe any of the proposals along those lines, I won't say anything about that.
What is the biggest hierarchy
part? That one, cosmological constant.
Is the picture that the compactifications are fixed once and for all? I mean,
well, no, there's dynamics. They're moduli, and there can be light fields describing those moduli. So,
So how do you tell what compact, I mean, is there a theory by which you evolve from one compactification to the other, or how is it fixed?
Well, okay, that is a long and complicated story, right? And we don't really know the answer to that. What fixes the compactification, what freezes the moduli at the places where they should be, and so on. And that's sort of been a historical and difficult problem in the field. There are various ideas for how some of those might get fixed. There are these things involving non-perturbative effects, the so-called racetrack scenarios and so on, where you develop potentials for the moduli. But really, we don't have a completely convincing story.
Do people at least study the linear stability of compactification towards, look for bifurcation points or something?
Well, let me see. I mean, certainly in many cases, one knows that there are, at least in the most naive descriptions, there are massless modes, the moduli that correspond to deformations. There usually aren't examples of unstable modes. And then the question is, what nails the value of those massless modes? And that's where life gets trickier. Okay, so some questions to think about for the long run in this area is trying to write down concrete realizations of warped compactification scenarios that are both non-trivial and also yield physics that is at least close to the standard model. Let's be modest at the outset. Another interesting set of questions surrounds characterizing the possible kinds of warp compactifications, or you might even say something stronger, but we probably don't even want this, classifying them. And then another question is that of the stability of the hierarchies when you develop them. For example, if you develop one of these long tubes that looks like ADS space for a while, and that can generate a large hierarchy, is that kind of thing, is it really stable? Or are there, for example, unstable modes that lead to the thing to shrink down and destabilize that hierarchy? So that is a question which we'd like to understand the answer to. Some questions, well, these are questions for the long run. I'm not going to have much to say about those in this talk. Questions for this talk are, involve discussing features of the four-dimensional effective theories that arise from these warp compactifications, and probes of these effective theories. And in particular, I'm interested in questions like, at what scales did the 4D theories break down? And another sort of related question is, at what scale do they really exhibit strong gravitational phenomena? And much of what I'm going to say along those lines appears in this paper that I wrote with Ami Katz, who is a student at MIT. Okay, so let me first discuss some general scenarios. And the overall challenge, again, is to find a stringy resolution of some of the things or a stringy realization of some of the things I'm going to say. So first, the Planck brain scenario, and I'll start with that because there we do have a stringy realization, in a sense, of it. Say you start with a six manifold with some number of D7 brains and some number of D3 brains. You can get these things from F-theory compactifications, and this is work of Verlinde and collaborators. And say that you have a large number of these D3 brains, and you take them all to coincide. Well, we know that that means that you will develop in the geometry, effectively, an anti-de Sitter throat near the three brains. And so you'll have a picture that looks more like this. So that's an example of one of these warped compactifications, where the, I haven't written down the metric, but you will have a redshift factor in the 4D metric as well. As we know from the discussions of ADS-CFT near a three brain, and there is a cartoon of this, and let me explain what that is. That's the so-called RS2, Randall syndrome 2, from their second paper scenario. And in that cartoon, you replace this manifold, which after all could be quite small, say of order of the string scale in size, replace that by a point, and you replace this infinite throat by the extra direction in anti-de Sitter space. And then the directions along this are the four-dimensional directions that are suppressed in this picture. And so a set of words that go with that are you might call this end of the space a Planck ring. And you might imagine that that's where we live. For example, there could be some extra brains up here on which there are gauge degrees of freedom. So that is where, at least in RS2, where they assume we live. And then down here you have anti-de Sitter space going off to infinity where there is a horizon. And again, here's the metric of anti-de Sitter space. And then in this context, you have, say, a 5-sphere soaking up the extra dimensions. So that's one of the pictures I will be discussing. A variant of that is the so-called probe brain scenario. You might imagine that not all of these three brains go off to infinity. Some of them somehow get stuck or stabilized partway in the throat. And a cartoon of that picture is this scenario proposed by Licken and Randall, where you have the again, the Planck brain terminating the space, anti-de Sitter space, which is semi-infinite, and then a brain out here floating in the bulk, so to speak, where again you have gauge degrees of freedom, perhaps open strings stuck to the brain, and so that would be where you get our gauge world. Finally, what I think is the most interesting possibility is what I'll refer to as terminated ADS. It may be that in this warp compactification, you develop a throat that for a long while looks like anti-de Sitter space, but eventually somehow it rounds off instead of having a horizon. And we've seen how to do that in the context of a non-compact scenario where you don't have this compact manifold up here. Klebanoff and Strassler have explained how to find an ADS-CFT realization of this, of something that rounds off like that. Also, Maldacena and Nunez, and you might imagine that there are other ways of doing that. And actually, this is something I've been discussing just recently with Shamit Khatru and Joe Polchinski. We're investigating whether you really can sort of have your cake and eat it too, have both a compact manifold terminating the space on the upper end as well as this rounding off at the lower end. Now the cartoon of that is Randall and Sundrum's first scenario, RS1, where you have a Planck brain and then you terminate, you have a slice of anti-de Sitter space, but you terminate on a lower brain, which they call the TEV brain. Again, that's where we're supposed to live, on the TEV brain. That's where the gauge world as we know it is. And that's at some z coordinate, which I'll denote by rho sub t for TEV. Now, one of the features in this cartoon description is that this thing has a negative tension, which looks a little fishy. But of course, back in this original description, assuming that we can put all of this together, that is a perfectly regular geometrical object. Certainly the lower end has a perfectly regular geometrical description, and there's nothing negative tension going on there fundamentally. Okay, so that's what I have in the back of my mind about what these scenarios look like, and I will discuss them in the context of the cartoon versions. In particular, I'll discuss questions about the effective field theory in these cartoon versions as a warm-up to thinking about the theories in the context of the full stringy versions, some of which we're still trying to find. So let's start out with the Planck brain scenario and ask ourselves the question, if we have such a scenario, what is the low-energy effective field theory that a four-dimensional observer would see in that context. And so again, we imagine we have this, well, anti-de-Sitter space running off to infinity, and we live up here on a Planck brain at z equals rho as four-dimensional observers, and the question is, what's the four-dimensional effective field theory? Well, in order to sort that out, you have to figure out what the low-energy excitations are about this configuration. And you find the low-energy modes at linear order by solving linear wave equations, for example, the five-dimensional wave equation for metric perturbations or for scalars or what have you. And the mass spectrum that you get from solving those equations come from the energy eigenvalues of an effective potential problem with an effective potential that looks like this. It goes to zero as you go to the horizon, down to infinity in that direction. Then it rises up to some finite value, and then it has a negative delta function.
Box 5 is just the covariant wave operator?
Yeah, that's the, well, in the ADS background. Yeah. And so, so that's the effective potential, and you see from that immediately that there's a little bit of a question or a complication in trying to deduce the effective theory, namely that there are, well, there's no gap. You have modes of arbitrarily low four-dimensional mass corresponding to dynamics going on sort of far away in Z, down near the horizon. So you have that continuum, and so you ask yourself, well, so how am I going to give a low-energy four-dimensional effective description of that? And the answer to that is really provided, as we know, by the ADS-CFT correspondence. And let me just sketch how you spell out the application of that in this context. Get that straight. So this is just sort of a caricature of the calculation, but it should illustrate the essential points. So you imagine that you have, you're working about a geometry that has this Planck brain and then semi-infinite ADS, and that the dynamics about that is described by a five-dimensional gravitational action. G is the five-dimensional metric, M is the five-dimensional Planck mass, curly R is the five-dimensional curvature scalar, lambda is the five-dimensional cosmological constant. And then in addition, you have a Lagrangian describing the fluctuations of matter, of gauge fields on the Planck brain. So gamma is the metric induced by G on the surface at Z equals rho. And you have some Lagrangian that depends on the matter degrees of freedom, psi, let's call them. And then also a brain tension term, tau here, which is actually necessary to get a Poincaré invariant configuration. Okay, so the dynamics is governed by an action that looks like that. Of course, in general, it should include all the string modes and so on, but this cartoon will suffice. Now, we imagine that when instead of fluctuations about this background, that we can put the 5D metric into this form, where all of the non-trivial fluctuations are in the components of the metric along the brain, and certainly we can do that by choice of Gaussian normal coordinates. And I'll keep the original parameter of the anti-de-Sitter space manifest. That's the anti-de-Sitter radius, and keep the scale factor or the scaling with respect to distance down here also manifest. And so we have here both the effective induced metric, which involves the r squared over z squared, and what I'll call g. That's the metric induced on a slice of constant z. And this metric g here is actually relevant for the ADS-CFT description that I'm about to give, or equivalence that I'm about to give.
G is a Lorentz signature metric?
Yes. This, yeah. Well, both are, the five-dimensional and four-dimensional metrics are both minus some number of pluses.
Just checking.
Yes. This is supposed to be Lorentzian. Okay, so now let's think about the quantum dynamics, and you can characterize that by, say, thinking about the functional integral. And so you might imagine doing a functional integral over all of the five-dimensional metrics down here with fixed boundary metric, fixed gamma, at the grain. And that's, of course, weighted with S5, the five-dimensional gravitational action. And then, in addition, you want to integrate over the possible boundary values, the possible induced metrics on the boundary, and over the dynamical degrees of freedom corresponding to the gauge modes moving on the Planck brain. And so at this point, one can use the ADS-CFT correspondence sort of extended by cobbling together cobbling together work of various people. So this is still a bit at the conjectural level. There are issues of how the cutoff works and so on. But the basic idea is that this quantum dynamics of anti-de Sitter space terminated at some finite z can be represented equivalently in terms of the quantum dynamics of some conformal field theory variables. I'll call them chi. And then there's some action describing the conformal field theory. There's a counterterm action which depends on the four-dimensional metric, which I'll give in a second. And then there is a cutoff, and that cutoff is, depends on rho, the position of the place where you terminate anti-de Sitter space. And finally, the metric that enters in here in the CFT action is this rescaled metric, g, not the induced metric, gamma. Okay, so I've recopied that expression here. The counterterm action you deduce in, is deduced in a couple of those works that I just cited, Henzingsen and Skenderis, Balasubramanian and Krauss. It depends just on the four-dimensional metric. It has a term that turns out to be precisely of the form needed to cancel the tension term in the four-dimensional action that we put in the first place. And then it has a term which looks like the standard Einstein-Hilbert action in four dimensions, where the four-dimensional Planck mass squared is given in terms of the five-dimensional Planck mass and the ADS curvature radius by that formula. And of course, that formula is quite reminiscent of the formula relating the fundamental Planck scale and the four-dimensional Planck scale in the context of large radius compactifications with a single extra dimension. So that's the counterterm action. And so we learn from this, based on this extension of the ADS-CFT conjecture, that the low energy theory consists of the original visible sector, which is described by a four-dimensional action that we started with, then this gravitational action, four-dimensional gravitational action described by S counterterm, and then that couples the visible sector to this conformal field theory described by the variables chi. And I'll refer to that as a dark conformal field theory because the only coupling to the conformal field theory variables is through the metric. Okay.
I'm slightly confused about
my
picture, which I had about this CFT correspondence, which
right.
You could either do the functional integral over the bulk, calculate the aspect of the six elements, and then the equivalent integral of the conformal field theory would give those two. You seem to be
counting. No, I'm replacing one by the other. I'm saying I start with the integral over the bulk, and I'm going to replace it by this integral over the conformal field theory degrees of freedom in the four-dimensional conformal field theory.
But your original integral over the bulk came from
this. The original integral here did have a four-dimensional functional integral with some other degrees of freedom. Which are not there in the standard ADS-CFT correspondence. You don't usually put actual degrees of freedom off at the boundary, but here we're putting the boundary at a finite place, and imagining that there can be some extra degrees of freedom there, matter degrees of freedom. So that's where the extra functional integral comes from. Other questions? Okay, so that's our low energy effective theory. It's, again, consists of gravity and the dark CFT. But one obvious question then is, if it's a low energy effective theory, when is it effective? When does it break down? What's the cutoff? And is there any new and interesting physics beyond that cutoff? Well, in order to figure out where the cutoff is, let's recall that in terms of the metric G, the cutoff was at the scale given by rho. And this follows from the work of Susskind and Witten and so on. It's been confirmed various other places. Now, we don't really know, in terms of the conformal field theory, what the cutoff corresponds to that is given by, you know, terminating anti-de-Sitter space at some definite z. We don't have an explicit description of that in the conformal field theory, but you might imagine that what we're doing is eliminating fluctuations on scales less than rho as measured with respect to the metric g. That's roughly what we're doing with just as a rough idea without giving a precise description of that cutoff. Now, of course, the relevant physical metric for discussing four-dimensional dynamics is this induced metric, and that differs from the metric that enters the ADS-CFT correspondence by the rescaling. And so in order to figure out, in terms of that metric, what the cutoff is, we have to, well, rescale this relation, and we learn that in the physical metric, the cutoff is at the ADS radius scale. So we can replace the functional integral involving the metric G with one involving the metric, the induced metric gamma, with a cutoff scale at the ADS radius scale. And of course, the fact that we can, that that's the only place the scale enters is a property of the, well, it results from the fact that this action describes a conformal field theory, so there should be no classical dependence on the scale of the metric. Okay, so the dark conformal field theory description should be valid at scales large as compared to the ADS radius. It's worth pointing out that is independent of this arbitrary coordinate position where we put the brain to begin with, and that's as it should be. There is no physics in the position of the brain. Okay, so that's the effective field theory. Now let's discuss an amusing test, which I thought was posed by Lenny, so I had heard, but when I was up at Stanford, he seemed not to be too willing to take responsibility for it. I'm not clear.
Tell him the outcome first?
Well, this was before I told him the outcome. I'm not sure what the verdict was after. So we're going to use this four-dimensional effective theory to describe processes in a four-dimensional world. And one of these processes we might imagine is, say, shooting a particle at a big black hole with zero four-dimensional impact parameter. And if you do so, then surely the particle will be absorbed by the black hole. What happens. But on the other hand, from the five-dimensional perspective, you could see something slightly different going on. We know that in the five-dimensional description, four-dimensional black holes are described by things that have a radius that is proportional to their mass in the four-dimensional directions, but the size in the extra ADS direction is only growing logarithmically with the mass. So these things are quite thin. They are, have been described as pancakes. And so you might imagine that this four-dimensional particle really secretly has some component of motion in the fifth direction. And in fact, by that component of motion can actually fly by the black hole and miss it. So if it follows such a trajectory like that, surely it will escape the black hole. even though it has zero four-dimensional impact parameter. So this suggests naively that there's a paradox. Now, of course, to those of you who know about the ADS-CFT correspondence, you see immediately what the resolution to that is, but just bear with me for a second. So actually, that's part of a more general question of if you have some matter distribution corresponding to matter moving in the five-dimensional bulk, what is the conformal field theory stress tensor that that corresponds to? And the question, well, that question is answered straightforwardly, at least, well, one way of doing it is to solve the five-dimensional Einstein's equations for, given the stress tensor in the bulk, for the five-dimensional metric, and then find the four-dimensional metric as the induced metric on the boundary in terms of the metric you just solved for, then compute the four-dimensional Einstein tensor, depending on that four-dimensional metric on the boundary, and by Einstein's equations in four dimensions, which must hold, that had better give you the corresponding stress tensor in the conformal field theory. So that's one way of figuring out what the stress tensor in the conformal field theory is, or in the four-dimensional description is, corresponding to stuff moving in the bulk. Now, of course, step one is quite hard. You can, in general, solve Einstein's equations, but you can at the linearized level, and we've done so and gotten a general result true at the linearized level, but it's somewhat complicated, so if anyone wants to see that, you should look at the paper.
How local is it?
How local is it? Well, it's not completely local. I could give a cartoon of what it looks like. Okay, I've overused that word. Let me use another word. I'll give an approximate formula. So I'll put it on this side of the board. The stress tensor in the conformal field theory. Unfortunately, that's the level at which we're discussing this subject, is to some extent at the cartoon level. But anyway. Okay, so the general structure is you take the five-dimensional stress tensor and differentiate it twice, and then propagate it using the Green's function, that's the bulk five-dimensional Green's function, to the boundary. So that's roughly the form of it, but it's more complicated than that, and there are T mu z and T z z terms. And so on. Okay, so again, the formula is in our paper, but it seems like it's something, it came out kind of complicated, at least in the case I'm about to describe. It simplifies greatly, and one might wonder whether there is a more simple formula that reduces to in general, and I don't know the answer to that. We looked at that some, and we're not successful in simplifying it. Okay, so let's just summarize what that formula tells us in the case of this falling point particle. So in the five-dimensional picture, we imagine that we have a point particle falling off the brain. Well, what does that correspond to in the four-dimensional picture? Well, the ADS-CFT experts, of which many of you are, would have already guessed that this corresponds to spreading in four dimensions. And the surprising thing, however, is that this spreading, well, you could imagine that it's just sort of spreading out in some fuzzy cloud, but in fact the spreading is on a shell, and the radius of the shell grows with the, well, with time. So this shell lies on the light cone.
Just because this delta R is the light cone, z equal rho.
Well, I'd like to think there was a I'm not sure that there's a simple explanation that is exactly that.
Well, it can't be what I said,
because
z is not
time. Z is approximately time asymptotically. There probably is some simple geometrical optics type explanation for this, but that's also something I'd like to.
What if we just take your formula here?
Yes.
But the point in there.
That's what I did. That's where this picture comes from.
Yeah, so delta R spreads out on some cone, right?
Well, okay. Well, you can do the computation. It's not transparent at the early stages that it's on a cone. Wasn't to me. But in any case, it's true that it lives on the light cone. So you have this expanding spherical shell that grows with time linearly. And it has a thickness, and that thickness is, it turns out, roughly the ADS radius scale, which makes sense because that's what the cutoff is in the conformal, in the effective conformal field theory. So falling in the five-dimensional sense corresponds to spreading in the four-dimensional sense. And this is what Horowitz and Itzhaki discovered in the case where we have infinite ADS and are working in the full ADS CFT correspondence without a Planck brain. And in fact, there's a sense in which you can take a limit of our calculation, I believe, and get their calculation. And of course, there's a four-dimensional explanation for why this works in the conformal field theory, provided by Coleman and Smarr and resurrected by Gary and Sunny. Basically, if you have a stress tensor that's conserved and traceless and positive energy, although they argue that can be relaxed, then there's a simple argument that matter described by that stress tensor will always stay on the light cone.
Is Sidney Coleman and Larry Smarr?
Yes.
I can't believe they were.
From the old days.
No, it's like there's no gluon, you know. What they were trying to argue is that there were no blue balls that would be like gravitational gions that would sort of hold themselves together for some long time. And so this argument basically shows that, you know, anytime you try to localize some things, it'll expand outward as fast as it can, basically expanding out at the speed of light, and actually, it does get concentrated on the light cone and not fill up the interior of the light.
Okay, so we...
Strictly speaking on that,
Okay, so that's an answer to our little puzzle. We see a nice correspondence in the five-dimensional gravity. Something falls, and that corresponds to spreading, and then you can see that directly in the conformal field theory, and that leads to the resolution of this puzzle, of course, namely that if you have a particle that is falling as it sails towards a black hole. In the four-dimensional description, that corresponds to this expanding shell. And the condition that the particle misses in the five-dimensional sense is the condition that it reaches a z greater than the z giving the horizon thickness here. And that translates into the statement on the four-dimensional side that the shell has gotten to be much bigger than the radius of the black hole horizon. By the time that the shell, the shell's moving in from the side, by the time that the shell reaches the black hole, it has to be much bigger. And so, indeed, the particle or its corresponding object, the shell, is not absorbed by the black hole, and that's a check of the conformal field theory as an effective field theory. I should mention, of course, that one would only see, again, this expanding shell through its gravitational field because, again, this is, in effect, dark matter from the perspective of the other degrees of freedom of the theory.
Am I supposed to think of the shell as the wave function of the shell?
At this point, it's a... I'm working in a classical approximation. So it's just a classical stress tensor.
So are you saying I can't send a particle at the black hole?
No, you can, but what happens is, okay, you can send a particle at the black hole. If it stays on the brain, it gets absorbed. If it falls off the brain, then that corresponds to conversion into dark matter, and it's this expanding dark matter shell.
So what would we see that light living on the brain? I mean, sometimes it would go in, but other times it would get...
Sometimes you'd shoot an electron at a black hole. Let's take something without a conserved charge. You'd shoot a particle at a black hole and it'd go in. But if it falls off the brain, then that would correspond to the thing disappearing, that would be interpreted in four dimensions as decaying into these dark modes, okay? And once it's decayed into these dark modes, then into the conformal field theory modes, then we know that they move on these shells. So they expand outward. We'd only see that by performing LIGO experiments, but you know, we could in principle see that, and we'd see that that shell expands out to a size bigger than the black hole if it's going to miss. Okay, so the effect of field theory sort of nicely describes that phenomenon. What about going beyond? So I mentioned that at the scale 1 over r in energy, this correspondence appears to break down. At least I don't see how using the standard ADS-CFT how to push it further, although you might have guessed that you could. Really, if ADS-CFT is describing all of the bulk dynamics, you could push it further, but at least following a straightforward approach, it looks like there is a scale where this where the four-dimensional effective theory breaks down. What is the interpretation of that? Well, one way of explaining what happens at the 1 over r scale is that's the scale where you really start seeing gravity become five-dimensional instead of four-dimensional. It's analogous to in the large extra dimension scenarios, once you pass that scale, that's the scale of the Kaluza-Klein modes, and once you go to distances shorter than that, you really see the five-dimensional nature of gravity. You can also see the same phenomenon going on here if you look at the Green's function. So that's interesting and exciting, especially if you can see that in microgravity experiments, but even more exciting is the question of where gravity gets strong. And I'll use as a litmus test for that the production of black holes. So let's imagine the following experiment. Let's suppose we are colliding particles on the brain in some future accelerator, and we want to ask at what energy do we start producing black holes. Now, the threshold for black hole production is going to be given by the Planck scale, but of course, in this five-dimensional picture, really, we should bear in mind we should be using the five-dimensional Planck scale, and that's not the same as the four-dimensional Planck scale. So you could ask yourself how low you could take the five-dimensional Planck scale to be, and you know, is it low enough we might reach that scale in some future accelerators? Well, again, we have this relation between the coupling constants, or between the, whatever, the Planck mass in four and five dimensions. And we know that gravity had better look four-dimensional down to at least around a millimeter, slightly better than that now through constraints placed by microgravity experiments. That's the same in the large extra dimensions situation or in you know, these ADS situations. And that together with the knowledge of what the four-dimensional Planck scale is, gives a five-dimensional Planck scale that must be at least 10 to the 8 GeV, so you're out of luck, you're not going to make black holes.
What are the cosmic rays?
What, those are 10 to the...
10 to the 21.
Yeah, well...
I mean, the maximum.
Yeah, well... Maybe, yeah. This is more for illustration, however. That's right, that's also, yeah. So what? What is that? I thought it was higher than that. It's 10 to the 21. Yeah. Square root of. Oh, okay.
What?
Yeah. Square root. Huh. Yeah.
10 to the 10. Oh, just makes.
Well.
No, that's EV.
Yeah, EV.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, now
we've got
to get a factor of 10 to the
5th
or
something. Yeah. Okay, so in any case, these...
Well, it's 10 to the 21 times the mass of the proton, which is 10 to the 9. Instead of 30, take the square root, it's 10 to the 15 eV. Right, so that's bigger than
2
eV.
Yeah, it's 1,000 eV.
1,000
eV.
Very
cute,
such a
number. Yeah. Pretty much the black hole that made the Tunguska...
Well, no, these are little tiny black holes, and they evaporate almost immediately, basically. So.
I think we mostly notice them in an accelerator experiment. We produce them by using energy.
Well, we'll come back to that. But another thing is, this is not necessarily believed to be the most realistic scenario anyway. And in particular, well, you might ask, you know, sort of what, well, how do you generate this scale? This is just, you know, the best you could do based on experimental bounds, but there's no obvious way to generate sort of this large ADS radius scale. I don't know, maybe you can cook something up, but this is not the, not sort of the most, well, the nicest scenario in several respects. So let's look at other scenarios. First, there's this pub brain scenario, which I talked about, where you have Planck brain and the probe brain. I'll put those at z equals rho and z equals rho sub t. And remember that the relationship between rho and rho sub t is chosen to produce the hierarchy. It's the ratio of the five-dimensional Planck mass to the TEV scale. And that doesn't look so bad when you work in proper distance coordinates, which are logarithmically related to z. In proper distance, these two brains are separated only by the log of this, and so it sort of looks possibly natural to actually generate the hierarchy, because the, you know, the obvious geometrical number is the log of that scale, or of that ratio of scales. Let me not get into the plausibility of that. That's a good question, but try to describe the four-dimensional theory that would result from this if such a thing were true. So again, that would involve the five-dimensional gravitational action, and then on the Planck brain, actually, let me keep that in the picture. On the Planck brain, we'd still have this tension term, but then we imagine that we, as gauge excitations, live on the probe brain, and so we're going to couple to the metric, the induced metric on the probe brain, not the induced metric on the Planck brain. That actually leads to a little bit more trouble in understanding the four-dimensional description in terms of the ADS-CFT correspondence. You might guess that at least for long wavelength fluctuations on the brain, that the metric on the probe brain and the metric on the Planck brain are related just by this simple rescaling. If you do that, then indeed you can relate this to, well, you can relate the metric on the probe brain to that on the Planck brain and write down a four-dimensional theory involving the metric on the Planck brain as the only metric variable entering the system. And so at large distance scales, indeed, one expects to find a theory, a low-energy effective theory, that consists of visible matter, four-dimensional gravity, and again, dark CFT matter. And again, the nice thing about this hierarchy generated by this separation is that you could start out with particles with a natural fundamental mass scale of order of the Planck mass, and then generate, by the relative redshift between these, four-dimensional mass scales that are of order of TeV. Now, where does this break down? This relationship that tells you the relationship between the metrics is a little too naive. And in fact, it fails if you have fluctuations on too short of a distance, because there's non-trivial extra z dependence. If you have something, you know, something wiggling down here, it's got, produces a gravitational field that depends on z as well, off in these directions in some non-trivial way. You can figure out how that works in the linearized approximation, again, by staring at the Green's function, which we've worked out. And the relevant corrections in the Green's function come from a term that looks like this. And you learn from that term that if you go to scales short as compared to this distance scale in terms of the ADS radius and the ratio of the masses, that it scales short as compared to that distance, your four-dimensional description is failing you in some way. If you assume the most natural situation, namely that the Planck mass, the five-dimensional Planck mass, the ADS radius, and the four-dimensional Planck mass are all of the same order of magnitude, then the scale this corresponds to is about 10 Fermi, it turns out. What's the interpretation of what's going on? Well, again, what's happening here is you're seeing truly five-dimensional dependence in the propagator for the graviton. And so this is, again, analogous to the Kaluza-Klein mode threshold in large-scale extra-compactive, or large-scale extra-dimension scenarios. And so we're discovering that, well, the four-dimensional description of gravity breaks down. But of course, we're not going to see that happen anytime soon in microgravity experiments, which are only operating just below a millimeter. So that's part of the story. But another way that this effective theory can break down is the following. And that is, you might imagine that you could reach the true Planck scale in five dimensions. And that's actually, because of these large redshift factors, much easier than you might have thought. Let's suppose that you have a process taking place down on the TEV brain with some proper energy, E proper. Well, then the energy as measured with respect to the Planck brain is redshifted by the redshift factor. So I'll call that E4D. And actually, that is the relevant energy for discussing, say, couplings to gravity and so on. That's the relevant energy as observed when we say such and such process is taking place at a TEV. One way of seeing that is that you should be referring the energy to the Planck brain is to notice that that's where the graviton wave function is concentrated. So what does that mean? Well, what that means is that if you are going to a four-dimensional energy that is of order of TeV in terms of what we see, in these scenarios, really, you're going to an energy that in the proper frame of a five-dimensional observer on the brain is the Planck energy, the five-dimensional Planck energy. And so that suggests that you should indeed generically be seeing strong coupled gravitational effects once you reach that scale in this kind of scenario. So you collide protons and antiprotons together, you might make a black hole.
Steve?
Yes?
I don't fully understand this.
Okay.
E proper, if you're an observer on this program,
yep.
Okay, and you're there watching it and you measure right. The energies, is that what you said called E proper?
Well, if you were a five-dimensional observer, right. Yeah, that's, just think of this as a five-dimensional problem. That's the energy as measured by a five-dimensional observer on the probe brain. But
that E proper,
that's what E proper is, yes.
And
then the 4D energy is the energy measured with respect to an observer on the Planck brain. And so that's redshifted. Rho over rho T is small. Okay. Now that is the relevant energy that enters into, say, the low energy effective Lagrangian, enters into the coupling to gravity, and so on. Because, again, because, well, you can see that several ways, but one sort of way of saying it is that the relevant thing is the coupling to the graviton zero mode. That's the 4D graviton, and the graviton zero mode lives up here.
But isn't this just saying that, in a sense, the proper Planck scale is the TV?
Well, it depends on where you live. If you were doing TV scale scattering experiments up here.
It's going back there, but you could, just frame it all in terms of where we are.
Yeah, well, okay, but again, it depends on where you're doing TEV experiments. If you do a TEV, something that looks like a TEV experiment up here, that's not going to reach the Planck scale. If you do one down here, it is. So.
But you still need to build Planck scale accelerators.
No. When you, TEV for observers on the TEV brain is the Planck scale in terms of proper energy. That's the statement.
Gary's right, it's the Planck scale.
No. It's okay. It is in the.
But he told me that if I'm on this brain where everything's happening, this right. brain, And I measure the energies with my, you know, measuring apparatus. I'm going to measure E proper.
Yes. No, sorry. We will, in our effective description, we will measure E4D. Okay. When we say 1 TeV, that is E4D equals 1 TeV.
That is the Planck scale that we measure. If we were to define the Planck scale,
No, that's not, actually. That's not right. Another way of saying it, let me say it another way, and that comes back to how you generate the hierarchy, right? If you have a particle with a fundamental five-dimensional mass, which is the Planck mass.
So, I mean, it depends on what you mean by that. It's not the Planck scale that we would measure by measuring Newton's constant.
Right, okay.
It is the
yes.
Planck scale we would measure by measuring the gravitational force as a function of energy.
Yes. Yeah. It's where it's where gravity gets strong. Yes. That's right. Right. Yeah. But yeah, it's not the same as M4. But yes. Okay. So the moral is, if we're all on the same wavelength, the moral is that if you go to energies that LHC would measure as a TeV or maybe the next accelerator, then you can reach strongly coupled gravity in this type of scenario.
Do you afford to link the construction or not?
I'll answer political questions after the polls close. So, actually, the polls on that should have closed already.
Yeah.
Anyway.
After the election.
Okay. Well, okay. So now this looks quite promising, but there's one. Well, you have to ask yourself, what kind of black hole would you be producing here? There are two kinds of black hole solutions known in these scenarios. One is a four-dimensional black hole that I was talking about, bound to the Planck brain. The other is the five-dimensional black hole, which falls following an approximate geodesic in anti-de Sitter space. Now, if we're thinking of this as a probe brain, it seems... Well, we certainly don't know of any solutions where we would bind a five-dimensional black hole to the probe brain. It's possible, but it seems more likely that what happens is this thing falls off. And if it falls off, we're back to the description we were talking about earlier, where you have this complicated spreading dark conformal field theory state that you're never going to see. So you make black holes at LHC, but you won't see anything. You'll see missing energy. Well, okay, that would be interesting. Yeah, whether you could really study things this way, but you're not going to answer really, you know, questions like what happens to a black hole when it decays this way, and that's what some of us think are the really interesting questions about black holes, although just producing them is great. Now, you might say, what about producing things that look like, you know, the real bona fide four-dimensional black holes, namely these things bound to the brain? Well, it turns out that since those live up at the Planck brain, the threshold indeed is, in energy, is the standard four-dimensional Planck mass or Planck energy. So
sorry, Steve. The matter is on that orange thing, right?
Yep.
So why are we ever forming a black hole up on the black hole?
You can imagine, say, radiating you smash together, you know, E plus, E minus, and you radiate some bulk mode in a virtual process, and that hits the brain and creates a black hole. It's clearly, it could be, you know, there could be some suppression factors or something. There probably are some pretty significant suppression factors.
So I would have thought you'd collide the matter if you form a black hole where the matter is.
Well, also, well,
somehow there must be, as that hole gets bigger, but there must be some threshold beyond which it has to turn into the other.
The second picture.
Yeah, you could make these bigger. That's another thing. You could make this sort of bigger and bigger, and maybe it sort of gets sucked up to the, or somehow sticks to the Planck brain.
Well, I think if you make it bigger, it'll look like your second picture.
Well, okay. Well,
just sort of, you
know, yeah, but this is at a way. Let me talk about the second picture in a minute. That's not what we. Mm-hmm. We're not at that energy scale yet. That's up at a much higher energy scale. These energy scales, you know, I haven't thought carefully about how you would really produce this, but it's clear that there are virtual processes that could mediate the production of these things. They might be highly suppressed. So, again, you know, you could have a bulk graviton E plus, E minus, bulk graviton smashes into the Planck brain.
And you have a collapsing star on the Orion sheet, which makes a black hole.
Well, okay, that's another story. This is the story at up at the, if you're just at threshold for making black holes, little tiny ones, Planck scale black holes. Now you might ask, when can you have a black hole that really intersects the Orion sheet? The answer to that is when you make black holes that have TeV size Schwarzschild radii. So that's a much higher energy. That it is an extra factor of, you know, M4 over TeV. And those are the things you're going to start to make if you, you know, really get a high energies, or if you have astrophysical things going on, you would be making this kind of black hole.
But the naive picture that black hole sticks to the Orion sheet is just
not
right?
Well, it's really, no, it's stuck to the Planck brain. The Planck brain is the heaviest thing in town. But to us, it still looks like a black hole. We're traveling along here. We see a horizon here, and so on. Okay, so the moral is that in the probe brain description, you might make black holes at a TeV, but they probably disappear. It seems pretty likely. And actually, I think that's also a potential issue in these large-scale extra dimension scenarios. There's a lot of space to wander off in. It's a, you know, maybe the black holes bind to the brain, or, you know, maybe they wander off. And if they wander off, you're not going to see them decay, for example.
Black holes don't wander off brains. I mean, that violates all sorts of classical laws, right?
Well, they can get kicked off in the collision, for example.
Well, they have to, right, it has that. You have to have enough force to pull it out so that the brain, you know, somehow snaps back in some sort of complicated process involving some brain dynamics. But it's not just like a particle passing through air where, you know, it's going to...
Well, I agree there's some potential attraction. Although we don't have a microphysical description of those scenarios anyway, so we really need one of those to really honestly discuss the question. But there could be a restoring force, but who knows?
Is there a third possibility? Can the falling get stuck at the horizon? Because massive objects will naturally fall towards the horizon.
Doesn't get stuck there, it'll just pass through the
thing. Right,
I mean, well, that's infinity with respect to, I mean, that's just spreading out to infinity in 40 degrees.
This is a massive object, and so...
You want this one or the one before?
The other one.
It's
the one that's stuck to the orange brain.
Yep.
That's a massive object, and so in the absence of the brain, it would fall into the horizon.
Right, yes.
And so it will only...
Right, so it's got a pull on it. One way of saying it is it's, you know, it feels the force of gravity pulling down, namely it wants to follow a geodesic. And so the TeV brain would have to restrain it to keep it on there. And it seems quite likely that what would happen is that the mass of this, although we really need a microphysical model, including a stabilization mechanism and all that good stuff, but it seems like what would happen is this would sort of pull the TeV brain and then it would snap off of the TeV brain.
So that's what you say, it would be hard for the opposite apple for it somehow turn into a black hole on the Planck brain.
Yeah, again, there may be suppression factors, certainly, right. Yeah, if you're at energies below a TeV. Another amusing thing down here in this story, actually a little over time, but I'm almost done. Another amusing thing is that you might say, well, matter here on this brain could fly by one of these. And of course, the answer to what's going on is, well, this is a little tiny black hole. Matter moving here of moderate energies is very long wavelength, and so it doesn't see much cross-section to hit that. So there's a nice correspondence to the earlier story. Okay, in any case, that whole thing looks like you have to make at least some pretty serious assumptions if you're going to see gravity. Strong gravity, but I'd like to turn finally to the terminated ADS scenario because I think this is much more promising. So just in short, we expect the effective field theory to again be correspond to a dark sector now gapped because there's a finite distance between these. You don't have the infinite ADS. The Kaluza-Klein scale should be like with the probe brain scenario, the same Green's function calculation should roughly describe what's going on there. the energy at which you reach the black hole threshold, the black hole threshold should again be a TeV. But the interesting new fact is that in these scenarios, the black hole has nowhere to fall. It would like to fall down, but it can't go any further, so it's just going to stay in the vicinity of the TeV brain. And so it should stay coupled to whatever matter is living down here, namely visible sector modes. So you would expect generically there to be decay in the visible sector modes, and indeed in the ADD scenario, the large scale extra dimensions, Gary and collaborators gave an argument that you would generically expect to see a large contribution of decay into modes on the brain. And so the same considerations should hold here. And so this seems to be a fairly generic prediction of these terminated kinds of scenarios, that you could reach the black hole threshold at, you know, energies comparable to the TeV, and really see the black hole decay. You might then ask the amusing question, well, what would be the signatures in experiments? And that obviously requires some thought to really pin that down, but there are a couple of general features. As you go to energies far above the TeV scale, you're going to start making black holes that behave more and more semi-classically. And so, in particular, you will start seeing the thermal decay spectrum at the Hawking temperature. And also, another, I think, striking feature of these kinds of objects is they have, you know, black holes have lifetimes that grow with their energy or mass. And I don't know of other examples of elementary objects that have that same property. Usually you make resonances and you go to higher and higher energies and, you know, you don't have this rapidly growing lifetime as a function of energy.
So you don't have a continuum.
Yes, that as well. Right. So these things could, you know, if you start making them, they could really stick out like a sore thumb. Maybe, you know, one needs to think through all of this in a lot more detail. And in order to do that, I think what you really need is a concrete realization instead of a cartoon of this scenario. So just to conclude, I'll make a little table here of what we've discussed. So we've discussed these three, again, cartoon scenarios we have in mind underlying string theory realizations that are possible. The effective field theory for the Planck and Probe brain situations are, gravity plus the conformal field theory, or in the case where the space is terminated, you'd have some theory that develops a gap. You have these different scales in the different
gap
theories.
Quantum field theory, what means that there's always some cold dark matter?
With some mass, yeah. Well, oh, is it? Yeah, it's necessarily cold, I guess. Yeah.
Well, so it depends on the gap.
Yeah, it depends on what the gap is. But let me see, what would the gap be in, say, Polchinski-Strassler?
The Jev.
The Jev, okay. That's cold. Okay, so
How much matter is there in this pipe?
That's a I don't know how, I haven't thought through the cosmology carefully, how much you'd make. That's a good question. Maybe, well.
So. Yeah, I mean, there's lots going on.
Yeah.
I mean, because in the end, there's things that don't get gapped, that get gapped at higher orders. I mean, it's like any Susie breaking model.
Okay, right.
But you have to worry about closing.
Probably. Yeah, that we probably do have to worry about that.
Yeah, but, I mean, again, the latest, these things are like, I mean, this gap is likely to be TeV size, but then there'll be you know, lighter things. I mean, both, you know, which are the real dark matter.
Mark disappeared. He would have the answer more quickly. But okay, so there are different scales that in the different theories where you'd start to really see gravity become five-dimensional, say in microgravity experiments, and then there are different scales at which you have strong gravity. So the Planck mass, of course, in the Planck scenarios. The possibility of reaching it at the TEV and probe brain scenarios, but then, as I've argued, that is likely to be hidden. You wouldn't really see the black holes being formed, although, you know, well, it's an additional assumption, I think, to assume that you would really see them being formed. Let's phrase it that way. So maybe a more realistic scale to expect to really see strong gravity is the true four-dimensional Planck mass. But then in these terminated ADS scenarios, there's the possibility of really reaching it at a TEV and seeing it. I've given sort of a toy example of the correspondence between the conformal field theory, the use of the conformal field theory description as an effective field theory description in this particle sailing past a black hole through the fifth dimension corresponding to a shell expanding around a black hole. And then finally, I'll leave you with the, again, the open questions that I think are interesting, and one of them is this problem of really constructing an example of a scenario where you might see black hole production at a TEV for real. Then there is this generic question of stability of these hierarchies and the set of questions surrounding, you know, what types of warp compactifications can we make? So that's it. Questions? Yes, Jim.
You talked a lot about producing black holes by colliding.
For example.
But there's the old process that Hawking used to like to talk about, which was a virtual black hole that would fluctuate, right? Would go in and
something else would come out. Right.
And so by lowering the Planck scale, of course, the suppression factor was roughly U minus M squared over M Planck. So that's much larger.
Who says they're virtual black holes?
I'm sympathetic to that point of view, that they're virtual black holes.
You've got an interesting rate for some process that you've heard.
Well, the problem is, well, yeah, let me see.
Well, you've got a theory. This is the quantum theory of Rec, you presumably will
answer well,
the question of whether it's virtual black hole or not, right?
There are lots of virtual stuff. It's like asking, you know, what's the probability for a virtual house?
Well, my question is, if you're
many more interesting things going on. You've got to remember, Hawking was pushing that thing as a way of arguing that in ordinary processes there'd be a violation of unitary time evolution.
Right.
No one in this community believes any bit of that. So asking a question about a virtual black hole is sort of, who cares? There are lots of virtual stuff, and lots of processes, and you know, it's just like asking, can you calculate a photon scattering off a virtual uranium atom?
There is one qualitatively different signature, possibly, of virtual black holes, and that's violation of global charges, right?
No global charges.
But yeah, that's. Okay, you have to believe in them first, and then you might.
Okay. I mean, if we believed in them, then we would have to accept Hawking's argument from the beginning.
Yes.
I've got to go on first, maybe an appointment for two.
Okay.
Your argument for Wigner, I believe.
Okay.
Any other questions?